Welcome to the Error Bar. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Pete Lush. I'm a postdoc at the University of Sussex.
Great. Welcome. It's great to have you here. Can I get you a drink?
Cup of tea.
Cup of tea. Perfect.
And a biscuit.
Biscuit for sure. So what brings you to the Error Bar?
You invited me.
Fair enough. It's a good point. So I've overheard some lively discussions in the bar about the rubber hand illusion. Maybe you can tell me a bit more about what that is.
Yeah, sure. So the rubber hand illusion is an effect that was first written about 20 years ago, over 20 years ago now. If you imagine the situation, you're sitting at a desk as a participant. There's a box in front of you that you put your hand inside so that you can't see it. You put your right hand inside there. And then there is a fake hand, a rubber hand, that would be placed about, I think it's 15 centimetres away from where your hand is. So the situation is you can't see your own hand, you can see a fake hand. The experimenter then takes two brushes and begins to stroke the fingers of your hand and the rubber hand at the same time. So in synchrony, this is usually referred to as a synchronous condition. So if you think you're sitting there, you can't see your hand, you can see a fake hand, and there's this synchronous brushing going on. It's brushing in the same place and at the same time on each hand. So what you're seeing on the rubber hand is matching, hopefully, what you're feeling on your own hand. Now, this is talked of as a multi-sensory illusion, and by multi-sensory, it just means that there's two signals going on, two key signals. You've got vision, you can see the hand, the rubber hand, and you've got this tactile, this sense of touch, you can feel the stroking of the brush on the other hand. And people report following this procedure, which really varies in length. Sometimes people do it for up to 10 minutes or so, other times it's just a minute or so. After this procedure, people will then report an experience of touch felt on the rubber hand rather than on their own hand, and an experience of ownership of the rubber hand. The way it's measured in the illusion is that they're asked whether they agree with the statement, I felt as if the rubber hand were my own hand. So that's your basic setup. There is then a control condition where the brush strokes happen at different times. So this is usually called the asynchronous condition. Although the touch is going on both hands now, it's happening at different times. The most important measure is the subjective report, because we're talking about experience. So if it's going to be about this experience of ownership and touch transferred or referred to the fake hand, then we need to ask people what they're experiencing. And the way that that's typically done is to give a set of standard statements that describe experience of the illusion. For the referral of touch, this would be something like, I felt the touch of the paintbrush on the rubber hand. And for ownership, it would be I felt as though the rubber hand were my own hand. People report on a scale. So a score of 0 on this scale would mean neither agreement or disagreement. A score of 3 is the maximum score for agreement. So that would mean I strongly agree with this statement. And a score of -3 is strong disagreement. That's typically how subjective report is measured. There are other measures, which are called implicit or objective measures, these indirect measures. The most popular of those is proprioceptive drift, a measure of where participants perceive their own hidden hand to be before and after the rubber hand stroking procedure. So you would be in this situation, you might typically set up a ruler in front of you and ask you to point or to say where on this ruler you felt that your hand was positioned before they start doing the rubber hand illusion procedure. And then afterwards, they ask you again, where do you feel like your hand is now? And you'd see typically a shift in the direction of the rubber hand, the shift in the reported perception of the position of your own hand towards that of the rubber hand. There are other objective measures. There's a skin conductance response, galvanic skin response. This is a measure of arousal. Usually in that, the rubber hand would be following induction. The rubber hand would be threatened by a hammer or a knife or something like that. And you'd see a spike in arousal. There are other objective measures, but those are the key ones.
And do different scientists agree on which is the best measurement of all these, or is there something that trumps the others?
There is disagreement. Some people just use proprioceptive drift, perhaps because they don't trust the subjective report entirely. I think it ultimately comes down to, if we're going to be measuring experience, everyone accepts that it has to be tied to report at some stage, the report of where you feel like your hound is. It's only linked to an experience of ownership by these subjective reports of ownership. And that kind of goes for all the objective measures. So I think everybody probably accepts that this crucial subjective report. Then there's a control condition. There's a couple of different control conditions. I'll just talk about the one, because it turns up in the vast majority of studies for both subjective report and for indirect measures like proprioceptive drift. In this control condition where the hand is being stroked, like I mentioned before, this control condition, this is also used for objective measures as well. So the experimenter will measure the proprioceptive drift, this perceived hand location, when you can't see it, after synchronous stroking with the brushes and also after asynchronous stroking with the brushes. All this has built into a huge body of literature, which claims to show us, I think it's been very, very popular. And I think this is because there's this idea that the experience of body ownership of our body is so fundamental to our experience generally. The idea that it can be disrupted in this way just through very simple multi-sensory stimulus for a very brief period of time is really surprising. I think that's a really surprising finding. I think that's really been generated a lot of excitement, because it seems to tell us a lot about how our experience of body ownership comes about through multi-sensory integration processes, that is the combining together of information from different sensory sources to form a sort of inference about what is our body.
It's exciting because it's an illusion and it's like you're gaining another body part or swapping someone else's body with yours.
Yeah, but I think that the key thing is that it's really exciting because it's really surprising, right? It seems like it might be somewhat maladaptive to be that easily mistaken about whether that's your body or not. You can see how that might be disadvantageous in an ancestral environment. You know, I don't want to go into sort of just so stories about the rubber hand illusion, but I think it's surprising for those reasons. You would think it would be difficult to create those kind of changes.
Because you can fall asleep on your hand and wake up and your hand's gone numb, you've had a temporary anesthesia and it feels rubbery and dead, and it kind of feels like you've lost your hand a little bit, and lots of disorders are like that. But gaining another hand or someone else's hand is a bit stranger, you're right.
Yeah, or if you imagine a situation, if you imagine a sort of real-life situation, you sort of, you know, we're at a bar or something, at this bar, and someone bumps into you, and they're just, you know, the person standing next to you at the bar, their hand happens to be touched in the same way as yours at the time when you were standing there. You don't, I mean, maybe people do. This is, you know, it's an interesting question. Do people think, hang on, is that my hand or is that my hand? It's a case where, very specifically, this is something that is generated in a laboratory setting. It's a very specific setup. You're sat there in front of a rubber hand. Your hand is hidden. There's a very specific sort of situation going on in this particular context.
And do you feel the rubber hand illusion? Have you had it?
No. To be honest, I'm not sure what the ownership question really means. I'm not quite sure how to interpret it. So I don't know if I experience that. The referred touch, the feeling of touch on the hand, that doesn't happen to me spontaneously, but I feel that with a sort of effort of imagination, I can imagine as though the touch was on the rubber hand. I think I get some insight into the experience then, perhaps. There's something to point out as well, that about around about 30% of people don't report the rubber hand illusion. Some people report very strong experience of the rubber hand illusion. For the ownership statement, these numbers are smaller. I think it's more like about 50% of people actually report an experience of ownership.
So I remember back in my PhD a long time ago, I remember feeling it and then not feeling it later on. And I've tried many times to get back in there in the illusion, and it doesn't really work for me with the traditional version, but other versions, they have been strong. So, what is it that explains different people's susceptibility?
Take a segue into another area of psychological research. And this is the history of imaginative suggestion. It's been primarily studied within the context of hypnosis. Everybody's got a rough idea of what hypnosis is. Usually people would think it's being controlled by some sort of authoritative figure. But the way that hypnosis is usually measured in the laboratory is through scales, these standardized hypnotizability scales. These would typically be preceded by a hypnotic induction, which can take virtually any form. Usually in these scales, it will be some sort of relaxation procedure, counting down and being told that you're in a state of hypnosis. But a hypnotic induction can also be riding on an exercise bike, as long as you've been told that it's hypnosis. It can just be, now you are hypnotized. It can be anything, pretty much, as long as it establishes a, what I refer to as a hypnotic context, establishes that this situation is a hypnotic situation and things are going to happen. In other words, people's expectancies, what they're expecting to happen, is kind of primed for something to take place.
And some people can't be hypnotized.
Exactly. So when we're measuring hypnotizability, so the scale that we use, for example, has 10 imaginative suggestions. An imaginative suggestion is a sort of an invitation or a suggestion that you will experience a counterfactual state of affairs. A typical one would be, for an ideomotor suggestion, as we call it, maybe the magnetic hand suggestion, that you hold your hands out in front of you and then you can feel a force, a magnetic force, and your hands are drawn together as though by a magnetic force. And then we'd ask people to report on a 0 to 5 scale how much they felt a magnetic force between their hands. So it's a subjective report, like we see in the rubber hand illusion. They vary in difficulty, these suggestions. So something like that, an ideomotor suggestion like that, about 80% of people can respond to. For the much harder suggestions, something like hearing music or being shown something and being told you can't see it, so negative visual hallucination, these are more sort of less than 10%, that 5 to 10% of people experience those. And then there's the cases that are in the middle. So paralysis, the hand not being able to move, is about sort of 50 to 60%. Things like being able to taste sweet or sour taste or feel a mosquito walking on your hand or hear it buzzing around you, there's more, I think, around 20% or so. So we take people's responses to all these items, all these different suggestions, and give them an overall hypnotizability score. These scores tend to be stable over long periods of time. This is a trait. So it's been measured over a quarter of a century. The test-retest reliability is high over very long periods of time. So it seems to be stable. There's an important point to add. I talked about the hypnotic induction could be virtually anything. We can go a step further. You don't need a hypnotic induction at all. You don't need any context of hypnosis. You don't need this word. There was a study by Gandhi and Oakley like 20 years ago, which I really like, where they gave the same procedure with and without the word hypnosis and found this little, they got a little boost in response from the word hypnosis. So it's like a sort of magic word. And to me, that sort of probably represents the context that people carry with them that primes their expectancies a bit more. But we recently have just validated a new scale, this phenomenological control scale. This is the same, we use the same hypnosis items, we use everything exactly the same, but we took out all reference to hypnosis and induction. We actually got a higher response for the non-hypnosis than the hypnosis conditions, which we put down to perhaps negative attitudes. I think there's reactants. Some people are coming, I don't want to be hypnotized, or if I'm hypnotized, it will mean I'm weak-willed, etc.
That's me, yeah.
So when it's presented instead, so we're trying to move away. There are a few reasons, I think, to try and move away from this word hypnosis. Partly because none of this stuff is necessary. And it carries all these negative connotations and also misleading connotations. There's suggestibility. People think of this word suggestibility, but that's misleading in that it brings to mind other forms of suggestibility, such as, you know, social compliance or being suggestible in other ways. Responding to a imaginative suggestion doesn't mean that you are socially compliant or suggestible. It's something that people actively do, but don't feel like they are actively doing it.
So people come to the experiment with being more or less suggestible, more or less hypnotizable. They're sitting down at a table with a rubber hand in front of them. So they have expectations about what they're going to feel. Is that right?
Yes. And the important point is that they will vary in their ability to be able to meet those expectancies by generating some experience, by imagining something, but probably not being aware that they are, that that is what they're doing. So if you think this hypnotizability scores, this response to imaginative suggestion is normally distributed, it's stable, means that every time you run an experiment, everybody's going to be drawn from this distribution somewhere. You don't know whether they're the sort of person that reports nothing for all these imaginative suggestions. They don't experience any paralysis, they don't hear any mosquitoes, nothing. Or whether they're somebody who gets all of it and are completely blown away by it and it's like a life-changing experience for them. It's just sort of, wow, this was the most amazing. And I should say as well that there's a lot of evidence that there are changes of experience in imaginative suggestion. A hypnotic suggestion for analgesia, for example, is people will repeatedly choose that over other forms of anesthesia for dental surgery. If there's not any experience involved, it would be quite a commitment to pleasing the experimenter or pleasing the dentist. You'd have to, you know, gritting your teeth, going, I'm going to pretend this is working. Yeah, so if we establish this situation where you're running an experiment, people are going to arrive. If they were measured on one of these imaginative suggestion scales, they would come out somewhere on this distribution of how much they report or a wide range of experiences just because they are told they're going to, just because they expect to. And so if you imagine those people in this rubber hand situation, I mean, any of these people, you imagine that you sat there, there's the rubber hand there, your own hand is hidden. In a situation like this, so I think probably here's a good place to talk about the concept of demand characteristics. Demand characteristics, this is a term that was introduced about 60 years ago by Martin Orr, who was a hypnosis researcher. It grew out of hypnosis research. He defined it as any cues, any aspects of the experimental situation, or any pre-existing beliefs of participants that could affect expectancies, affect expectations in an experimental situation. He pointed out, or he argued, that when you're studying humans, if you're running an experiment with humans and they turn up, and if you've ever participated in the experiment, as I'm sure you have, we're not just blank slates. We don't just sit there absorbing, you know, or just performing the tasks that we've been instructed to do. We can't help ourselves. We're constantly trying to work out what's going on. It's an effort to stop yourself guessing what it is that you're supposed to be doing. And Orne argued that, therefore, that what people expect in an experiment can bias the responses. Some people might want to try and be a good participant and give the experimenter what they believe the experimenter wants. And this can bias responses. Also, people might just be, you know, they might be socially compliant and they might just bias the responses in that way. And that is typically how demand characteristics have been considered, that this is something that you're only really looking out for compliance and bias. You're not looking out for genuine changes in experience. And that is the key point that we're making when we talk about the rubber hand illusion and when we talk about a range of other effects that we've been looking at as well. And this is that demand characteristics, what you expect in an experimental situation, may lead to the generation of experience by the same mechanisms as people respond to imaginative suggestion. This is what we call phenomenological control. So you expect a particular experience, you generate that experience according to an underlying trait ability. And I think that if you take a situation like the rubber hand illusion, But if you are, some people will, they really seem to have had an experience. They're really wowed by it. It doesn't seem like they're putting it on. They're going, whoa, that was amazing. And there will be things like you can have skin conductance responses change. They seem to have genuine experience. These things are reflected in various things like that. But if you have run imaginative suggestion screenings, if you've run hypnosis screenings, you get the same kind of responses. You get, there'll be some people who are just really blown away. Wow, that was amazing. How did you do that? I can really, you know, it's like there was a mosquito walking on me. I couldn't move my arm. These are, from the perspective of somebody working on that, it seems that that's not to me any evidence of a difference in mechanism. So if we return to this demand characteristics idea, we can think about what people might expect in the rubber hand illusion. You sat there, you've got a rubber hand there, you've got your own hand hidden. You can try and introspect about this. The experimenter starts to stroke your hand at the same time. What is that experimenter expecting to happen? People are going to be trying to work that out. If people can work out that they're expected to feel the touch over there on the fake hand, and if they can work out that they're supposed to feel like that hand is their own hand, then this could act as like an implicit imaginative suggestion. I should make a side point about imaginative suggestion here, that typically the imaginative suggestions that I'm talking about are delivered verbally, they're direct. It's sort of like you will feel a magnetic force between your hands. But hypnosis grew out of mesmerism. It developed from mesmerism, sort of 18th century suggestion effect, which was attributed to the manipulation of magnetic fluid in the air. At the time, that was plausible enough scientifically. 100 years later, it wasn't so plausible, and that's when hypnosis came along, or neurohypnosis, as it was first termed. In mesmerism, typically there would be a sort of something like waving hands over the body or iron rods over the body. Mesmer used iron rods at first. These were supposed to be, you know, they manipulated magnetic fluid, and then he fell out with his iron rod maker, and then he discovered he could do it with his hands.
This is getting very close to the invisible hand illusion.
There are some striking parallels. Yeah. So waving hands over somebody, you don't tell them what they're going to experience. Instead, they just respond in some way. And they would, people would have convulsions, or they'd be cured of things, or, you know, just a huge range of, there's a wide range, anything they can come up with really from that situation and what they know of what mesmer does, what other effects people have had. For example, the trance state, I think, seemed to come from, and I pronounced this wrong probably, there was this guy, the Marquis de Puysegur. Before, mesmer had mostly just treated people with mesmerism in the, you know, in the courts, in amongst the wealthy people, and everyone knew what to expect to some degree because they all chatted amongst themselves. But this guy decided to try and take it to the people and to the poor, and he got this subject in who fell into a trance. And as far as I know, I think that's the, there's probably people who would argue about this, but as far as I know, I think that's the birth of the trance state that came to be formative of hypnosis, or crucial to hypnosis, because he didn't know that he wasn't supposed to do that, would be my interpretation. He's like, this guy's doing all this. I mean, I don't think he's consciously thinking that. I think that's just what he expected to happen. And then after that, once this guy had fallen into a trance, then other people start falling into trances too.
So if I understand, your research that you've recently done shows that people they come into a rubber hand illusion experiment, and how suggestible or hypnotizable they are can explain why they respond the way they do in the rubber hand illusion. Is that correct?
Well, the degree to which somebody reports experience on a hypnosis scale predicts the degree to which they will report experience of the rubber hand illusion. So we talked about this asynchronous condition, the synchronous condition. So we set up this situation where people may expect something given this particular context. And I'd say also I point out that the scientific context has quite a lot in common with the hypnotic context. You're in this situation where, I mean, the scientists wouldn't have got you in there unless they expected something to happen. It's this sort of authority figure, scientist, taking the place of the hypnosis. Your expectancies are raised. what's important in this situation is the controls for domain characteristics, that is, the controls for what people expect. The control for domain characteristics in rubber hand illusion studies, chiefly whether they're using objective measures or subjective measures, is this asynchronous stroking condition that we discussed earlier. So the key assumption there for this to be used as a control is that people expect experience similarly for synchronous and asynchronous conditions. I think if you just introspect about that for a moment, imagine yourself receiving these two conditions. Would you expect the same experience in both? I wouldn't, but I tested it. Just use a very simple procedure. This is based on ideas of Martin Orne's again from the 60s. Just basically describe the procedure to people. They didn't take part in a rubber hand illusion. I showed them a video that showed the procedure, didn't say it was anything to do with illusions or rubber hands, etc. And described the synchronous and asynchronous conditions and showed the synchronous and asynchronous conditions, and then just gave them the questionnaire, the standard questionnaire from rubber hand illusion, but for what they would expect to experience if they were a participant in that experiment rather than what they did experience. And we find that what they expect in the synchronous condition and what they expect in the asynchronous condition differs. That is, they expect the experience for synchronous stroking, they don't expect it for the asynchronous condition. And the same goes for proprioceptive drift, and the same goes for skin conductance response. People, on average, know that they are supposed to experience something in the synchronous condition, not the asynchronous condition. What that tells you is that this is not valid as a control condition. It's usually used to, I mean, it could control for other things, control for sort of touch and visual stimuli, but it's not usually interpreted in that way. It's interpreted as a control for domain characteristics, therefore a control for what people expect. You can't control for something using a measure which is very different to in the thing you're interested in. You can't control for expectancies with something that people expect differently. So that's the situation with that control measure. It's not valid, which means that there's the possibility that the rubber hand illusion is, these reports and these objective measures are compliance bias. This is the key step we take, and phenomenological control, that these are people responding to their ability to meet their expectancies for experience.
And after 22 years of rubber hand experiments and hundreds of papers reported and people correlating the rubber hand with lots of conditions, that message kind of been very welcome from a lot of researchers. Is that how has the field taken these results?
Yeah, there was, I don't know, maybe I was naive, but I was a bit surprised really at the reaction. It hasn't gone down well. There's complete disbelief. From some people, there's a failure to even entertain the possibility. The thing that struck me the most is the lack of interest in the domain characteristics control issue. Nobody's argued with me about that, about why that could be a valid measure for domain characteristics. I haven't had that argument, but it is that the arguments that people are making about the relationships between phenomenological control and rubber hand illusion report are being based on ignoring that issue with the control method. So I find that quite strange and surprising, but I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be surprised, and this is just how these things go. You can't expect people to open their arms to something like that. From my point of view, I try not to get too engaged in things that I can't control, people's reactions and such like. For me, I focus on, I've got an alternative theory, and we've got evidence consistent with that theory, and we've got evidence that the existing theory isn't as solid as was thought. To me, that's just normal science. If I'm wrong, then it will strengthen the rubber hand illusion because stronger valid controls will be developed. I don't think that in the long term, I don't think there's nothing to lose from it. But I get the impression that people feel that they're losing something. But I don't see it in that way, because I think that every time we discard a particular hypothesis or find some new evidence, I mean, that's learning something more, right? That's science. I know it's very difficult to, if you're invested in a thing for decades, I can see that there's a personal reaction to that, which is maybe very difficult to overcome. And I don't know how I would respond in that situation. But I think that as scientists, it's just something that we kind of have to expect, right? If you go into science, you know there's going to be change, disagreement, alternative theories.
So I think your paper's been really influential. I checked your citations yesterday. It's something like 30 times it's been cited, some of them by you, but...
Probably most of them by me.
It's already created a lot of noise, and this is in a good way. And it's been picked up by lots of media channels that I regularly look at all the science news online. And something I've noticed about news reporting is that it's all based on press releases, pretty much. So universities will put out a press release that'll get picked up by someone. It'll get retweeted on all these news resharing platforms. And so I guess, do you feel that the way the press release was done or worded, and it got so much attention at the beginning, that that's what's upset people? That it's sort of, here's this high profile study and it disagrees with you all. Do you think it was the phrasing or the framing somehow that made it stronger?
I can only speculate, but I do know that the arguments were just as strong before there were any press releases about it. I mean, this probably led to, I mean, that's why I ended up doing the demand characteristics study, because people would not take the idea seriously. So,
when was this? Is this a previous paper?
Well, the phenomenological control paper, the one that reports the rubber hand illusion and imaginative suggestion response correlations, that was, I conducted that study like 3 years ago, and then it was up as a preprint not that long after it was completed. So it's been out there for a long time, and it's caused arguments every step of the way. So I don't know, maybe. I mean, in that paper, I think in the press release you were talking about, the demand characteristics one, you sent me a quote. I don't actually know what that quote means and how it got in there, but it says that that I've said that the rubber hand illusion isn't fit for purpose. I didn't say that, because I don't know what the purpose of the rubber hand illusion would be. What I said was the control methods for demand characteristics are not fit for purpose, and as a consequence, all the evidence that's based on them requires reappraisal. I think that just follows from that. But it's not going to be a fun thing to hear if you've been working on it for 20 years. I get that. But I also don't think that it necessarily should censor that. I think that we need to kind of face these things head on. But then maybe that's easier for me to say from where I'm sitting than for somebody who's invested in it.
I mean, you must be invested a little bit, because you spend a lot of time collecting hundreds of participants, you know, a much larger study than most other people. So you've got a lot more data than the average.
Yeah, well, it was done in a week. It was an opportunity sample. We did it in 353 people in the space of a week. It was quite intense. So that was it, really. And then I've just run these other sort of online studies. I would say that I'm not heavily invested in it, because for me, and this is what I really want, I think that to make more sense of all this, I think we need to sort of look at the bigger picture. The rubber hand illusion was one of three examples in our paper reporting relationship. We also looked at mirror touch synesthesia, which is when people report feeling touch when they see touch. And we reported similar things for similar relationships for vicarious pain, which is when people feel pain when they see someone else in pain. And for those, you know, I don't think that necessarily this is just demand characteristics. In those cases, people report, the same people who report it in the lab report it outside the lab. So I think it's a question of mechanism. These things have been attributed to certain mechanisms, but they may be working by the same mechanisms as imaginative suggestion, maybe a sort of habitual phenomenological control. So ultimately, I think all this comes down to a question of what we need to control when we're measuring things, not being, I think there's probably, for people studying each of these things, they maybe have experienced these things themselves. If you've experienced something yourself, you might be less worried that it's the main characteristics. But if you're an experimenter, you're also going to be drawn from somewhere on this distribution, right? You may never have been screened for these things. You may well be able to generate experiences to meet your expectancies and not know. It tells us nothing about mechanism if you've experienced it yourself. And similarly, things like skin conductance response. This was, I mean, at one point, this was a measure of the hypnotic trance state. This is something people can voluntarily change their skin conductance response. You can do it just by simulating emotion, by imagining emotions.
Yeah, I've done that. I hooked myself up once and just thought naughty thoughts. And yeah, or like, you know, you can beat the lie detector by putting a pin in your shoe is the classic movie example.
Exactly. But in the rubber hand illusion literature, there's always, when there's skin conductance studies, there's always the assertion that this is an objective measure that is resistant to any kind of voluntary control. And I think that maybe just comes through because people already believe that this thing's real because they've experienced it themselves. Speculation entirely, but I do think that might be a part of it, that it's hard to be sort of, there's quite a few steps you have to take before what I'm saying would seem at all credible, and maybe, you know, won't seem credible then either. Yeah, there's another one we've just looked at as well. This I'm hopefully going to have this paper up very soon. Visually evoked auditory response. This was it went viral a few years ago with this GIF of bouncing pylons. I don't know if you saw that. So these things jump, and then people report spontaneously hearing stuff. This has been studied since. There's a very large scale study with about 10,000 people, which we've basically replicated. Not with 10,000 people, but we've just done that and correlated with phenomenological control, and we get the same kind of relationships again. So the other thing I'd say is that for the rubber hand illusion, for example, I'm not saying that it's definitely all suggestion effects. I'm saying it might be. The only way through that, I mean, at the moment, nobody knows. And the way to deal with that is new controls.
In your ideal world, what would the best control look like? What would be the conditions and what would be the prediction?
The first thing is the way that it's been done with the synchronous and asynchronous conditions, trying to show that the score is higher in the one than the other, that's fine, we can retain that. But it's just that they need to be matched in expectancies. You need to make sure that people expect experience in the control condition to the same degree as they do in the illusion condition. So there's one example that I consider might turn out to be quite effective for controlling the multisensory stimulus. But if you wanted to try and get at the contribution of multisensory integration, that would be using a laser light. So if you use a laser light on both hands, then you could end up with, you might end up getting very similar expectancies, which you could test in the same way that the tested expectancies of the rubber hand illusion themselves, and just do an online study, show people the things, see if it matches across groups.
There has been a study with laser lights and...
Yes. So the thing is that when that's been done, you do get the effect.
Weaker, but you...
Yeah, so that suggests to me that there may be something left over there. If the expectancies match perfectly, and then you still get this difference, you still get more response to the brush than you do to the laser lights, then we can't say that's down to expectancies, right? If expectancies don't match for those two conditions, though, and the difference in expectancies between the laser condition and the brush condition is similar to the difference in the result, then it's not a good control again.
Can't you use the data you've already got, like as a... This is techie and nerdy, but like as a covariate, couldn't you put the expectancies in to a model and sort of regress them out? Is that not possible with your existing data?
You can't at the moment because we don't have anything that's matched in expectancies, I would say. We need, first of all, the controls to... I don't think we can do anything meaningful with the asynchronous control condition. I don't think comparing those things is useful. It's just too different. It's apples and oranges. I think the first step is to get something that is matched. It's too messy otherwise. There's a second thing that I should add, why this won't necessarily work as well. But the second thing you need is I talked before about the difference in response to different imaginative suggestions. They vary in difficulty. So 80% of people can report some experience of magnets between their hands. Only 4% of people will report music. Expectancies will be roughly similar for these. I mean, you know, maybe not expectancies of particular effects, but the expectancies are going to be closer than they are in some situations. If we take a different measure, so just like we might do for synchronous and asynchronous conditions in the rubber hand illusion, we can take a different measure between one suggestion, such as magnetic hands, and another suggestion, music. And we have quite a large difference. And this is a difference that really represents the difficulty of the suggestion. Now, if you correlate that against hypnotizability overall against the rest of the scale, you can end up with no relationship. I've done this. I haven't got around to doing anything with it. But if your suggestion effects aren't matched in difficulty, then you could end up with something that's a suggestion effect being thought of as not a suggestion effect. So I think that those are the two things that you need to do. You need to match. I mean, it's a two-step process, match expectancies and match difficulty. And it's probably going to be difficult to get that perfect. But if somebody did that, then I would be very happy to say, yeah, what's left over is not easily attributable to suggestion.
And there have been some replies and some ongoing discussion. Do you feel the discussion is moving forward?
Not in terms of, I mean, if you're referring to the commentary on the Nature Communications paper, it just, I mean, they present some things that we already presented in the paper, but argue the opposite for them. And I think there are two main points of contention. The first is that we report, and they've reproduced evidence for no relationship between phenomenological control, response to imaginative suggestion, and the difference between synchronous and asynchronous conditions. But the difference between synchronous and asynchronous conditions is constant, roughly constant across levels of hypnotizability. All that shows you is that basically there's a difference between expectancies similar across all levels. It can be accounted for by the expectancy difference. That argument requires ignoring the issue with the control for demand characteristics. And I do think that needs to be faced head on. It's a method. People expect the effect in the illusion condition. They don't expect the effect in the control condition. You can't meaningfully interpret that as anything other than expectancies. So that's the first disagreement. The second disagreement is the size of the effect, whether it's substantial or not. And for this, they take, I think we have around a 0.3 correlation. I'll say first that we only report, interpret the linear models because they're much more informative. But they use the standardized effect size, they use the correlation coefficient. We report around about 0.3, I think it's about 0.2 something, but let's just say roughly 0.3. They take the squared value of that, which is smaller, of course. It's an R squared of, I think, 0.09. R squared can be interpreted as the variance explained. But first of all, you have to look at this in terms of the linear model. And secondly, you have to think about what this means within the context of effects generally in psychology. If we take something like the correlation between height and weight in humans, that's around about 0.5. The squared value of that is 0.25. So we can say height only predicts, only accounts for 25% of the variance in weight. But I don't know. So I think that whether or not it's substantial comes down to, it's a matter of opinion. But I would say one thing, there was a study that my colleague Warwick Roseboom did. He simulated lots of studies, like 10,000 studies of the rubber hand illusion using our data from 350 people. The key step was that he split the data into groups by the median hypnotizability score, by the median response. So we had a group from the bottom half of the distribution of hypnotizability and the top half of the distribution of hypnotizability. And then he ran simulated experiments using these data at the median sample size reported in the rubber hand literature. And we ended up with, from the bottom half of the distribution, if we look, for example, at the crucial ownership statement, draw from the bottom half of the distribution, and 4% of those studies give you evidence for agreement above, for anything above zero in the studies. Whereas if you draw from the top half of the distribution, then 70% do. So it really matters. If you have got 20 people in your rubber hand illusion study, and those 20 people turn out to come from the bottom half of the distribution, now it's unlikely, but if they do, you're not going to have an effect. And if they come from the top, then you're going to go, whoa, this is work. I think that kind of illustrates the degree to which the relationship may confound these things. I would also say when I was looking into this at first, I was seeing it as more of just a confound and it needed to be dealt with, and then we'd see what's left over of the ownership. As I've looked at it more and more, I think there probably won't be much left of ownership scores. In large scale studies, there was one, Matt Longo's study, it was a factor analysis. And they reported, I think, a 0.7 average agreement for the ownership statement on a scale from, you know, 0 to 3, 0.7. Theirs was 0.4. In our study, it's 0.7. So, you know, split the difference. If we're only getting around about half a point of agreement at the group level on average with ownership studies, with ownership statements rather, once you've dealt with possible expectancy effect, I don't think there's going to be a lot left of that at the group level. I just think the numbers aren't very high. Typically, they're combined with, you combine the referred touch statements with the ownership statement, call all that the rubber hand illusion, and then talk about ownership. The referred touch doesn't have to have anything to do with ownership. And so I think if you look at that ownership experience in isolation, I don't think there's going to be probably a lot there.
Maybe people are just good at predicting what psychology experiments are, you know, so there's no necessarily reason why their expectations going into a experiment will determine their responses. They might just be have a good folk psychology theory of what's going to happen, and they make a good prediction on average, but they don't know how they're individually going to experience it. So how do you distinguish those possibilities that people are just good at reverse engineering the experiment, but it has nothing to do with how they actually respond?
For me, it's enough that if they can figure it out from being shown the procedure, I can't rule out the possibility that they're also figuring it out when they undergo the procedure. And that, for me, is sufficient doubt to question the rest, given the relationships with response to imaginative suggestion. And I think that when you look at, this is why I am trying to sort of move it on. I got bogged down in the rubber hand illusion for so long. It wasn't supposed to. It was supposed to be one study. But because there was such pushback, I've ended up having to spend 2 years on it. And it wasn't my intention to try and say the rubber hand illusion isn't what you think it is entirely. It was to say it's confounded as an example, along with mirror touch, mirror synesthesia, and as we're about to do with the visually evoked auditory response, as an example that this may confound things all over the place. So I think it may be that rubber hand illusion researchers feel particularly sort of targeted or singled out just because it's an accident of timing. We're still looking. We're going to look at everything. Well, we're going to keep looking at key candidates. So far, they all turned up. So there's something there to explain whether or not you think it's, even if you just think there is no experience in the imaginative suggestion, how much people are biased on their imaginative suggestion scores or predicts how much they're biased on these other things. I think that there is something that's got to be, but I think that there's something that ought to be considered.
I wonder if the focus, the Scientific American article, which covered your story by Simon Makin, he was a colleague of mine in Reading when I was there.
And oh, yeah.
It's very plausible, possible that he was a subject in one of my undergraduate students' rubber hand experiments. So I think he may have had a personal connection to that. I definitely would have talked to him about it in the pub.
Yeah, he did know about it. He had done it, I think. Yeah, he was very interested. And he talked specifically about his experience of it as well, and his kind of sort of in the way you did, that it wasn't quite as sort of necessarily as cognitively impenetrable or as fixed.
I gotta check my records to see if it was him who was a subject way back.
See his response.
So I'm surprised it was you just had that week-long experiment and it's generated, like, it's changed your life. You're now the rubber hand guy.
No, I really didn't intend to be the rubber hand guy, and I'm gonna do my utmost to not be the rubber hand guy. I mean, I'm doing it with other things one after another, so I'll probably just be the guy everybody hates.
So yeah, are there any regrets you have about the whole thing?
I think I would have jumped to the end point more quickly. I think that the response, I think I thought that when I raised it in the first place, people would go, oh wow, that's a concern, and start thinking we should have a go at sorting out these control methods. And that isn't what happened. We just had it's been opposition, really. Actually, that's mostly from the scientists. From the philosophers that work in or are peripheral to the rubber hand illusion, who use it in their arguments, there's been a lot more acceptance and even support. Maybe that's because, I don't know, philosophers are more used to sort of contentious argument in that way, that they're kind of, that's a philosopher's job, basically, is to come along and say, I've got a different take on this, disagree with you.
Yeah, I went to a lot of philosophy symposia things. You must know Frédéric de Vignemont, her stuff on the rubber hand. And they have a discussant with every someone presents something and then someone presents the opposite, and they disagree with each other, and then they go for dinner. And that's how it works in philosophy. But science, yeah, one is always building this tower of deceit, and then over years and years and years, and then someone comes along and takes out the weakest link and weakest brick, to continue the metaphor, and it all falls over.
And that's going to be upsetting, yeah. But I think it's something there that you say, you know, that sort of thing. Having more of that in science would be helpful. It would not getting so sort of attached, maybe, and letting this is idealistic, but trying to sort of, you know, like the Mertonian norms of trying to not be personally invested in your data as much as possible, be aware that you're going to be fooling yourself, and always be trying to. I mean, we're always, it's just how we think, because I mean, I'm going to be making the same mistakes, and someone will come along and, you know, if this thing manages to stand up for 10 years, then someone will probably tear it apart in 10 years, and then I'll be angry at them. But I'd like to think that I'll be able to. I'll try to. I would certainly be trying to think. All right. Well, what did you expect?
That's good. That sounds like a good. I'm just hearing the little excerpt at the end there, the end of the show. So let's just do that final little bit on one service we can offer you here at the Error Bar is you can confess a sin and you'll be a science sin and you'll be forgiven. Is there anything you want to own up to?
Yes. Yeah. I think that doing this has really kind of opened my eyes to domain characteristics. And now I'm seeing them everywhere. And it feels like there's this situation in psychology where, to me, it feels a bit like if, you know, after Fleming and penicillin, he pointed out, we realized from that that you could contaminate your Petri dishes if you didn't wash them. Like 10 years later, 20 years later, everyone would just stop washing their Petri dishes again. It feels a little bit like it's a sort of hiding in plain sight. And now when I read papers, I think I've just seen domain characteristics all over the place. And that, of course, also applies to my own earlier work. So I would say for a couple of my first papers, the domain characteristics, I used this measure intentional binding, for example, in one. And there's another one using Libet's timing of intention measure, so looking at differences in the awareness of intention in different groups of hypnotizability. But those people knew that they were being recruited from a hypnosis database, and they would also know whether they scored high or low on that database if they were able to work out which way their result could go. Then that might explain my result there. I'd rather it didn't, because I quite like it. I've done work on it since. But it's, so that's something that I'm looking at the moment. And also, this other one on intentional binding, I thought I was safe there, because how could people figure out, you know, intentional binding is this sort of opaque setup. You're pressing a button, there's beeps, you record these times, and then we have to work out what they're supposed to do. But then we thought about it in a different way. It was developed with Warwick Roseboom, this Q combination model, which also other people have introduced now independently. Then it really all boils down to the relative precision of button presses. And so if the domain characteristics just encourage one group or the other to just be a little bit less precise in their timing of their actions, the rest of the effect should fall out of that. Maybe I should say that again in a way that will actually not take 5 minutes.
You could give it a go. Just a snappy one-liner.
Otherwise, you're going to start there with the edit tool. Yeah, I would say, looking back at my own earlier work, now that I've been looking at domain characteristics, I'm starting to see them in other places. I'm seeing them, you know, you become aware of this thing of like, well, thinking, what were the participants expecting? Is there any way this could be domain characteristics? And when I look at some of my early studies, well, yes, there is. And I'm testing that at the moment. And if, you know, I hope not to be publishing a paper in a short while saying, yeah, my studies were domain characteristics, but, you know, we'll see.
A bit like when you discover regression to the mean, as I did as a PhD student, then you find it everywhere, and it's very disturbing.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, this is what Warwick always says as well. He's got, you know, he's just done a lot of psychophysics work, and whenever he's reading a paper, you can hear him just going, oh, it's, you know, it's regression to the mean.
Anything you want to completely random stuff you want to sort of suggest for future episodes, or like topics that annoy you about science, anything at all, like, or massive historical mistakes?
Oh, I've got a long list. let me think. I'll see if I can think of anything that would be particularly relevant at the moment. There's one thing that does bother me. I just did this paper about the proprioceptive drift things, the objective stuff. It's this whole thing of calling something objective. And it's not just in the rubber hand illusion, it happens all over the place. And you just call it objective. And once it's been called objective or implicit, then it is. Then it can, you know, it's unassailable from that point on. And then another thing happens, that if you call it, because it's indirect, you call it objective, and then because of that, you call it implicit. And then it becomes a measure of something implicit. And this is what's happened in sense of agency research, that you have this measure in central binding, and it's an implicit measure because you're not directly asking them about agency. But now most papers you see, it's sort of like, we measured the implicit sense of agency as distinct from the explicit sense of agency, drawing on this philosophical distinction, which just sort of like, well, it's not. It's just this kind of words, it's just this sort of definitional slippage. It's sort of amazing how much those things kind of accrete. But no, that's really just a pet one, because I get asked to review intentional binding papers probably because I did intentional binding, and so it's sort of every time it's not. In fact, I've even slipped that into the that paper on the rubber hand illusion, just as an attempt to try and reduce the number of times I have to say it.
So I don't expect you'll be doing much more rubber hand work in the future. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that by now, I mean, I would have tried to create some. It's been difficult because of the lockdown and all that. One thing we were going to do was show skin conductance from direct suggestion with the hand. Then it turned out I found a paper from 2008 where someone actually did that already. They just didn't call it imaginative suggestion. They just asked people to imagine that it's there. There's one other thing that I do want to do, just to make a sort of wider point, and that's to sort of induce the rubber hand illusion by just direct suggestion. Then reverse it that way, because we wanted to, so this is one thing you said, actually, you wanted a weakness of the study limitation. And an obvious limitation is that it was designed as an experimental study. We wanted to change people's expectancies for synchronous and asynchronous conditions and see if the responses match that, you know, see if we could get response in the asynchronous, not synchronous condition, when we change people's expectancies. But we couldn't change people's expectancies. And I think, looking back, I can see why that is, that they just didn't believe us. It's sort of like the synchronous stroking. You know, we had some story about, oh, when things happen at different times, it should be more something or other. But people just didn't believe us. We couldn't shift the expectancies. We got a reactance effect. We actually got a bit more of a boost in expectancies the other way, you know. They knew what we were doing. So I think I would like to do a something experimental with direct suggestion to try and sort of reverse the effect. The other thing is that, of course, because of that, it's just correlational. It only gets you so far, a correlation. I mean, that is my focus at the moment, though, is just to build up lots of correlational evidence from different areas. It's just very broad brush stuff. That's the main limitation, that it's correlational.
Welcome to the Error Bar. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hello. My name is Regina Zopf, and I'm currently in Sydney, Australia. And I study body perception, so how we perceive our own body. And I study that in healthy participants, but also in disorders like eating disorders. And for that, I'm particularly interested how different signals of the body sort of are combined and integrated, and how that influences our body perception. And then also how we use these signals to then interact with the world around us.
Would you like a drink?
Yeah, sure.
What can I get you? What would you like?
I might have some red wine, maybe a Merlot.
Excellent choice. It's great to have you here. Our last customer was Dr. Peter Lush, who's written recently a very controversial article about the rubber hand illusion. So can you tell me how you heard about this paper and what your thoughts of that controversy are?
Early last year, I read their first paper, which came out in Culabra, and which sort of was about this quasi-experiment where they described the illusion or different illusion conditions to different participants and then asked them to answer the typical rubber hand illusion questions. And I read that paper and I'd already mentioned the second paper that came out then later in the year, and that was still in preprint though. So I kind of already knew about both of these papers when it sort of came up on Twitter. And yeah, and I must say, initially I found them actually quite interesting. I sort of thought, oh, there's some interesting like new data and also some interesting criticism and findings that I think are interesting for the rubber hand illusion researcher.
So you weren't too upset by it. So one thing I've seen on Twitter is that people have been quite upset by this controversy, or they've got quite angry about it. Did those emotions not cross your mind?
Yes, I guess what crossed me was more that sort of this strong claim that they based on this data that the illusion, that the rubber hand illusion can be explained by suggestibility. I sort of just can distinguish between sort of a weak version of the data, that there's something maybe not quite right with the methods and that there's response bias that they can influence our methods. And then the sort of strong version that the whole rubber hand illusion can be explained by suggestibility, which is more this idea that this implicit suggestion can control what we actually experience in the illusion. And I think it's that second sort of idea that I think has been pushed quite a bit by the authors and also, I guess, the media and maybe on Twitter. And that's more what I have sort of a problem, but I don't agree with that. And I don't find that they actually have strong evidence for that. I'm not convinced.
Peter was very honest, I think, and very reflective about the whole process. And I think probably he maybe regrets a little bit the arguments. And I too found it quite strongly worded. But his argument, I think, is that there's this confound that when you put people in these strange situations and you stick a rubber hand in front of them, they naturally have some expectations about what the experimenter is looking for. And when he measured that in the quasi experiment, he found people would systematically say, yeah, the synchronous stroking is going to give me a stronger illusion than the asynchronous. And so without ever doing the rubber hand illusion, you can get strong responses to those questionnaire statements. So how could you deal with that, do you think?
Well, I think there are other ways to measure as well, that use measurements that are not as prone to these sort of expectations or possible response biases, that people can guess what the experimenter wants you to do, and which might even underlie these correlations that they then found in the second study. And we always knew that, I mean, it's not a new thing that we think that these subjective experiences that we sort of measure using these questionnaires could be biased by expectations and bias. And so I think one way is to use measures that are maybe not so prone and not so subjective. And there are quite a few as well.
His background and the team that he's working with, I think they talk a lot in the bar to me just recently about the history of hypnosis and the history of suggestibility. It's long been known that some people are very suggestible, and you can suggest things like you are now feeling mosquitoes on your skin, you are now blind, you are now, you know, as solid as a piece of wood. And people will go along with this, and people produce these experiences. So put in that context, in sort of the context of the history of science, it seems quite reasonable actually that put people in front of a rubber hand and ask them about their experiences. So his claims actually, I think they go even further than just about the what you might call the subjective questionnaire. In fact, they're also claiming that the proprioceptive drift and the skin conductance and maybe even other measures are also confounded by these expectations. Do you think that's a fair conclusion from his data?
Like, I have two parts to this, two answers. So maybe first I'll talk about why I don't really believe that there's strong evidence for the suggestibility idea. Although I'm intrigued by it as well, and especially when you think about the rubber hand illusion, you put this hand there and then you also have this stroking, and it's sort of quite rhythmic. And I also think maybe there is something hypnotic about this, that the whole setup is very hypnotic in a way, and it's often dark and things like that. But I don't quite, based on the data, I'm not convinced about the CO2 due to a few reasons. Like, first of all, we know that there's a lot of individual differences, right? So we have often 80% who get the illusion and 20% who don't get the illusion. So I think this is very intriguing. So we really don't know why some people don't get the illusion. But Lasche et al. Found is some interesting correlation that this sort of in a synchronous condition, the measures, sort of the subjective measures and also the drift correlates with this suggestibility or hypnotizability. But first of all, I think what we have to keep in mind, this was an exploratory finding. So it wasn't pre-registered. So they first did their pre-registered data analysis, but they also did some analysis that they didn't plan to do. So it's exploratory. And I think first step would be to actually replicate this and see if it's actually true.
Like, my second point is that these correlations can also be kind of explained by two types. Like, first, it can be this response bias, or it can be explained by these implicit suggestions, and then they control sort of the phenomenology to kind of respond to these expectations. So these correlations could in principle be just due to these response biases. It doesn't have to be any changes in phenomenology. So kind of these strong claim that something that happens in the rubber hand illusion by suggestions just changes the experience. Doesn't have to be the case. Given we know about these individual differences, we also in this study, what they found is that actually some people who scored quite low on suggestibility had also had the illusion. So they can't completely explain for these differences, or yeah, that some people really don't get the illusion because that can't really explain everything. Theoretically, I think what I also have missed in this whole discussion is I kind of think if they want to make this strong claim that what you change in the rubber hand illusion is you make these, you have these implicit suggestions, and then it changes the phenomenology, and there's it has nothing to do with kind of multisensory processes or something like that, but it's purely a cognitive top-down effect. And I really believe that they also need to develop a stronger theory. And I think this theory also has to then explain some other previously established and well-established rubber hand illusion effect. And I'm not quite sure if they can. And I give you an example. So, for example, in the rubber hand illusion, we know some factors have a strong effect and some don't. For example, when I see a hand, then I can experience the rubber hand illusion. But if it's just a block of wood, it's not possible to induce ownership or embodiment for that block of wood. It has to be kind of a hand, or hand form is really important, that it's sort of body-like. But other factors are really not so important for the illusion, like especially the skin tone or the details of the hands. But let's take the example of skin tone. Here we have basically the idea, or we know that somebody who has maybe dark skin tone can experience the illusion for a light skin tone and the other way around. And that's, for example, a finding that I don't really think this sort of suggestibility theory can explain, because in theory, when I see a hand that has a different skin tone to mine, I would really expect that this is not my hand, right? But at the same time, when we induce the rubber hand illusion, it doesn't seem to make a difference. For me, this is something that really can't be explained by this suggestibility idea, but we at the same time, we have a lot of these multisensory theories or multisensory theories on the rubber hand illusion that are based on multisensory processes. And they often are very much based on sort of temporal spatial aspect, how we perceive something in time and space sort of binds signals from multiple senses together. So if you feel something at the same time as we see it, this seems to be a signal that these things belong together. Or if we experience it in the same space, two different signals, and we also combine them together. And sort of these signals that are important for multisensory binding are really sort of important for the rubber hand illusion, whereas signals that are maybe like skin tone is a purely visual one. We can't feel skin tone, so they don't seem to be important. So that's really fits nicely with these multisensory ideas. And I think a challenge is then for this other theory to really explain it.
I understand all of that. My guess is that they'll have a response for all of these individual points.
Mm-hmm.
And that my guess is that they'll say things like, some suggestions are more difficult. So it's hard to get people to agree that they're blind in hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite easy to get people to agree that they feel a mosquito on their skin.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they might say that it's hard to get someone to agree that a block of wood is feeling like their hand, but it's easy to get someone to agree their hand. And in a way, I don't think it really matters, because they don't disagree that it's really experience. So people are really experiencing these mm-hmm. illusions. That's not a problem.
Mm.
But I also think you're right that they've got a lot of work to do. There's 22 years of results.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just the results that they've highlighted. There's lots of results. So yeah, I think I'm just agreeing with you. This isn't a question. I'm just agreeing with you again, I think. But I do feel they'll have an answer to all these things. But I also feel it's their job, or it's the job of future researchers to test all of these new claims.
But I think it needs a consistent theory, one that we can make predictions with and that are not post hocs.
Right. How do you know which conditions in advance are going to be more difficult to suggest to people? Like, how do we know that skin tone is not important, but hand shape is important?
Yeah. And a temporal spatial multisensory theory is, in my view, can much better explain the data than a theory that is based on expectations. Because I think expectations, you would expect the difference between skin tone, which we don't find.
Do you experience the rubber hand illusion?
Yes, quite strongly. Yes.
Because I asked Peter Lush as well, and he said no. I also don't really feel it anymore. I used to once upon a time, but I think I explained it away to myself. Do you think researchers are drawn into studying the rubber hand illusion in particular ways, depending on how they feel the illusion?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I never thought about it. Maybe it can influence it, but I don't know. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. We just have an N of one and one.
True. Yeah.
But
there might be a study there.
We need a meta study of the of rubber hand illusion researchers. So overall, do you think on current data we can explain away the rubber hand illusion, or is there work that you think needs to be done?
Yes, definitely. I don't think we can explain it away. And I mean, the illusion still exists in both theories, but I don't think we can explain away these multisensory effects and multisensory interactions that seem to be quite important, and sort of more of these perceptual effects.
Your work particularly, you've used a particular method to look at these multisensory correlations. And I think in one of their commentaries, Lush and colleagues suggested that even things that you and I might think are quite implicit and sort of automatic, these sort of reaction time effects in visual and tactile reaction time studies, even those might be explained by expectations. Do you think that's fair or even credible?
Like, I used the cross-modal congruency task and also reaching to sort of use more implicit measures or more indirect measures for the illusion, because I found it important to have these other, to look at this effect in addition to the more subjective reports, which can be, like we said, can be biased. And one of them is the cross-modal congruency task. And in this task, we basically have a task where participants have to discriminate the location of touches. So they maybe get a touch on the index finger and the middle finger, and then they have to respond as quickly as possible and say which one was touched, index finger or middle finger. And what is then done, like this multisensory aspect of it, is that then lights are added to the setup. And these lights can be above the index finger or the middle finger. And they can also flash together with the touches. And they can either flash at the same finger, so the congruent location, or at the other finger, the incongruent location. And what had been quite well known is that we can sort of measure multisensory interactions. And if these lights sort of interfere with this tactile task, then participants get faster when the light and the touch are congruent, and they get slower when they're incongruent. And the difference between congruent and incongruent is the so-called cross-modal congruency effect. Sort of, it's an effect of how much these light interfere with these touches, or detecting the location of these touches. And what I found in the rubber hand illusion is that I sort of did the same thing in the rubber hand illusion. I put the lights onto the rubber hand and then stroked either synchronously or asynchronously. And we find stronger cross-modal congruence effect in the synchronous condition. So the more after synchronous stroking the rubber hand, and the more people got the rubber hand illusion, the stronger these interactions became. So this cross-modal congruency effect was bigger. And now what's kind of nice about this study is, or about this task on this paradigm, is if one expects an effect as a participant, one cannot simply say, as a participant, I respond faster. I think in the synchronous condition, I need to respond faster. That's what the experimenter wants me to do, because that sort of cancels out. It's quite, you can't really, as a participant, manipulate this effect, I don't think, because it's, if you go automatically faster or slower on the task, then this would cancel out, because it's always congruent minus incongruent. So I think this in this task or this effect can't really be explained by response bias in a simple way. So I don't think that claim is sort of fair. Now, the other claim, again, is that the structure stability in the rubber hand illusion changes the phenomenology, that we have this cognitive effect. This could possibly have a top-down effect on this cross, on these multisensory interactions. So that's maybe a way, I could imagine could be possible. But I think, again, this would need to be tested. And I don't think it's easy to just claim and explain this away, because without testing, because you kind of then have a theory, the theory then is already, we don't just have this cognitive theory of the illusion, but we also have a theory of the illusion that then has to change multisensory perception. And yeah, I think that would need to be tested as much more complex.
Yeah, I definitely agree on the cross-modal congruency task. Probably studied 600 people with that task, and maybe not 600, maybe 500. And they didn't have an idea what the hypothesis was. I did ask them, what do you think is going to happen? They know the basic problem: when the light's in the wrong place, it's harder, but they can't tell you about spatial effects, left versus right, or near versus far. And even in an experiment when I think Charles Spence manipulated attention, they told people, I really want you to focus on the left hand. That didn't change the congruency effect. It's hard to interfere with that effect that I found and others have found over many years. So yeah, I think that's a good target that we can team up on the defending the rubber hand loom on that one.
Yeah.
The reaching though, I think they would argue that reaching movements where you can kind of work out what the experimenter is looking for, you could try and reach slightly more one way or slightly the other way. And I've had participants in my similar mirror experiments do exactly that. And I've asked them after the experiment, did you use a strategy? And some of them said, yeah, you know, I reached more towards this way.
Hmm.
Is that fair, do you think? Or do you,
yeah, I
think, how could you change things to try and remove that problem?
I mean, one advantage of reaching and is that what I often think is that it's also a task that doesn't have a direct body judgment. So it's not about the body, it's more about something external from the body. So anything that might influence, like we used it also in eating disorders, that might influence how you feel about your body directly, is kind of controlled because you have to do something non-body related, really. I mean, you still have to use your body, but the target is something that is not the body. But it is true that somebody could guess it. Like our reaching was very fast though, so I think it would have been tricky to strategically move towards the side, but it's possible because we always ask them to reach really ballistic and touch the target. And I think if somebody wanted to always reach towards the side, that might have been possible. But I think if participants really wanted to do the task and go with expectations, then they really wanted to touch that target. So I think, yeah, but it's more prone, I guess. Yeah, there can be a bias.
And I wonder if they would respond that because you really do feel your hand in a different place to where it is, then your reaching movement doesn't actually need to be biased. Maybe it's just maybe that's how they would respond, that actually we don't really mind about the reaching movements. It's not a problem because we don't disagree that the subjects really do feel their hand has changed location.
Mm.
I'm sort of thinking this through on the fly. So one issue that has come up in discussions with Peter and in my reading of the literature is that there isn't really a consensus on what exactly is the illusion. And this is really important for Lush's criticism, that do you just look at the questionnaire responses for the synchronous condition? Do you look at the difference between those responses? Do the responses have to be overall positive for each subject or positive for the group? Or can the illusion be measured by some of these other implicit measures? So it seems that there's no real agreement between anyone on what the illusion is exactly.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's very, can be very messy, or has been very messy, or it seems very messy. But I think one of the sort of reasons for this is I think that the illusion itself is so complex, and body perception is so complex. So when we have the illusion, it's sort of, it's not just that we experience ownership for the rubber hand, but we also feel embodied in this rubber hand. We feel like the rubber hand is in that location, that the touch we feel is coming from the rubber hand being touched. And we also have a bit this feeling that we can control the rubber hand. So there's quite a lot of complex, it's very complex, and there are a lot of different aspects. So it really has these multiple components. And like Matthew Longo has and his colleagues, they have investigated a long time ago and studied these different components, and like ownership, location, agency all seem to play a role in the rubber hand illusion and in this embodiment feeling. And I think that's sort of one answer why it is so confusing. What is the illusion? And because it really has all these aspects. In addition to these sort of subjective measures, we also have these other measures where we can observe behavior of people in the rubber hand illusion, like how somebody reaches or how somebody responds to touches or how somebody protects their hand. So there are all these different aspects of as well of the body protection and action and multisensory perception. And I think all of this is really part of the illusion. And I think if one decides on a measure, it's really important that one kind of thinks about what the question is and what measure and what aspects one is interested in. Is it like the complexity of the illusion, or is it just a subset? Also, if we sort of integrate and just calculate a mean illusion score, what does that actually mean? Or should we not look at different components always? And then, so I think it always will depend on the question, what measure is best. And with each measure, we should really carefully think about what potential problems is and how good this measure is, not just in what it measures, but also like the drift is often measured. There's just one data point taken. I think that's a very noisy measure, because we should really repeat it a lot of times and then get it less noisy. Yeah, and I think for all of these potential problems, there can also be potential solutions. So some people said they only believe in effects if it's if there's a positive questionnaire response and also an effect in the drift, or if there's a difference between synchronous and asynchronous conditions and so on. So it really depends also on the experimenter. But I think as long as one is clear why one does that, I think it seems okay in my opinion.
Do you think all these complexities can be resolved? Do you think more data or more collaboration or more meta-analyses? How can we resolve all this?
I think we just have to think more about the complexity and measure it more and try and get the best measurement we can get and try and then tease it apart and think more about it.
You mentioned it before. Did you see much of the discussion on social media or more interestingly, media reports of the rubber hand illusion of this paper? And if you did that change your view of the science or did you just sort of ignore the media?
I think it was really funny. I had a lot of people sending me the media reports. And I think there was also a media report for the first paper, but also, the second one. And a lot of colleagues sending me, what do you think about this? And it's at the end of the rubber hand illusion, and sort of had to explain what's sort of happening. So there was a lot of, I felt like it came up all the time somehow last year, and also in a lot of discussions I had, it somehow came up. And also, on Twitter, I saw it, and I don't really think it changed, because I think I read it before. I don't think I really changed my view on it.
Are you able to sort of step back from all of the complexity and the arguments and the media reports and think, what have we learned from Lush and colleagues' new study? It's not just one study, it's like four or five now. They're coming out with more. What have we learned from all of this?
I think for me, the most important thing is that our methods, like especially the subjective measurements, can be influenced by expectations and then response bias. But I think that was, to me at least, clear before. I don't think that was really a new point, but I think it just highlights it again. And I think it's an important, something important to take away, and it should influence us. And maybe we should try and maybe think about the questionnaires a bit more that we're using and develop maybe better control questions if that's possible, or try and kind of discuss how we can improve what we're doing there. And I think the sort of theoretical work, I think, like we discussed, I think that needs more work for me. I'm not convinced. And at the same time, maybe it's important that people in the field who've worked on the rubber hand illusion maybe pitch different theories against each other. And maybe will be interesting to kind of improve theories and how we talk about them. And maybe, we can improve each other's models that way as well.
And will you still be using the rubber hand illusion in your research?
Yes, I will be. I think there are still some open questions, and I mean, I don't have any direct plans at this moment, I'll be honest, but down the track, I think if something interesting comes up, I think it's a really great tool, because I'm interested in different signals and multisensory perception for the body. I think it's a great tool to, or experimental paradigm to introduce different conflicts in space and in time, and I think it's very, very useful to get to questions about the body, because it really allows us to manipulate something we weren't able to manipulate before, the rubber hand illusion.
So here at the Error Bar, we can absolve you of any sins that you've made, any scientific sins. Would you like to confess?
Yes. we talked a bit about the complexity of the rubber hand illusion and the different questions that we can use to measure the rubber hand illusion. And I must say that early in my career, actually, because when we analyze them, we can do different things. We can we can look at different components, we can look at individual questions, or we could, for example, also just calculate a mean score across all the questions. And one thing I did is that probably when I had my questionnaires of my participants, that I actually played around a bit and explored what might be a good way to analyze the data and maybe tried out different options, which I don't think I would do anymore like that, because I then later became much more aware of the problem that this might create in terms of bias, and I have pre-registered a report and have pre-registered a lot of my data or my analysis since, and that's probably a sin of the past, hopefully, for me.
That I'm not really proud of looking back.
You've reformed.
Yeah, just experiencing a pre-registration process sort of really showed me how important it is to like really not do that. And I mean, it's good to explore data as well, but I think I'm much more aware now of and much more explicit about exploratory and confirmatory analysis and findings. And so I try, when I talk about my work, I talk about it like that.
Well, you're forgiven as much as I can.